映画ナイト。
Hello and welcome to another episode of Eiga Night, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the wide, wonderful world of Japanese cinema. I am your co-host, Chris Luciantonio, and joining me once again is...
Aruba, who is finally back after another hiatus.
It's been forever, Aruba. Like, the podcast has not been the same without you.
Oh, I'm really sorry. Like, the thing is, though, you've recorded some pretty good episodes that I've been able to listen to. I was able to listen to the one with Nikita. I haven't listened to the one with...
With Moss. That was,
with Moss.
that was our last episode on Ikaru, which turned out extremely well. So I'm very proud of that one.
Yes, I'm very excited to take a listen to that. And you all should take a listen to that.
Mm-hmm. But since you're back, it's time to get back on our schedule of covering all the major works of Japanese cinema. And this is quite a doozy we have set up for today.
We really do. This one was supposed to be released before Halloween, you know, before all the Halloween demons got to me and my computer and our computers and kind of messed up our scheduling here.
Originally planned back in September, we have had this one, and like it's originally on the kind of doc that we shared between us that said like films that we really want to cover for the podcast. Like it's been sitting there forever, and it's kind of like the white whale of the podcast. It's like it's going to forever change the flow of it because this is a major work we're talking about today.
Yeah, so we really hope you enjoy our discussion on 1988's Akira.
A boy who was in an accident on an old city highway was brought to the lab. Seems that he's their new subject for human experimentation.
You must take a look at this data. It's phenomenal.
Is it safe, Doctor?
What did you people do?
The time of atonement is upon us. Are your hearts prepared? The time is nigh.
He's developed so much power in such a short time, it's unbelievable.
Keep away! Is that what Tetsuo's doing? Are you saying he has that kind of energy?
The thing about Akira's power is, it exists within everyone from the start. But when that power is awakened inside, it is important to wisely choose how to use it. Your friend has already made his choice.
Neo Tokyo is about to explode, just as it did 30 years prior when a psychic singularity connected to a clandestine operation by the Japan Self-Defense Forces wipes the former city of Tokyo off the face of the earth. Now, Neo Tokyo, a thriving megalopolis, rises from its ashes on a precarious foundation. A corrupt parliament is failing an expanding population, the JSDF has refused to give up its control of the Esper project despite its dangers, a growing terror cell battles a government for control of the flow of information, and the streets are plagued by violent Bosozoku motorcycle gangs that fight for control of Neo Tokyo's lower levels. There, a young boy named Tetsuo discovers he's developing his own psychic powers at an alarming rate, feeding into his megalomania and inferiority complex related to his gang leader and best friend, the headstrong Kaneda. As Tetsuo goes mad with power, the forces at work within Neo Tokyo's power structure clash in a growing confrontation that has the potential to raise the city into ashes. Aruba, can you remember the first time that you experienced Otomo Katsuhiro's mega work, Akira?
Yes, I do remember. I remember the first time I'd watched it in full was actually for our undergrad class Japanese film with Dr. Anich. Shout out to her.
Shout out to Sandy.
Yeah, thank you, Sandy. And I remember this was the one film that made me actually want to communicate with you all the morning before the lecture. It was an 8:30 a.m. class, and I had to come in as early as fucking possible to meet with the people who come in early to ask, what the fuck did I just watch? How could a piece of animation actually embody so much visceral feeling within my body that I physically felt ill watching some of the animation?
Visceral is really the word for it.
Visceral isn't the word for it?
No, it is the word for it. This is a very affecting film, both in its presentation and the way that and its themes and how it really explores them through its masterful animation production values. I remember specifically, I had seen the film before our discussion for that fateful morning back at Wilfrid Laurier University. This is kind of an inside baseball. I was talking to Aruba about this before the last time we tried to record this episode. Specifically in Canada, there's a television channel called Teletoon, and it's usually for younger kids, usually like cartoons for the entire broadcast schedule for the whole day. But like after I think either 8 or 9 o'clock, it switches to The Detour, which is more like adult animation focus. So that's where you'd see reruns of Family Guy, of Futurama, and a lot of the Adult Swim programs that we didn't have Cartoon Network in Canada.
Much like Toonami, yeah.
Yeah, it was like the only place to really see this kind of material, these adult animation shows. And it was also a place where they showed a lot of like more risque, more adult-oriented films, like on their Saturday night programs. And that was the first place that I had ever seen Akira through this weird lens of Teletoon children's programming broadcast, is where I first saw Akira, like segmented with commercials, obviously, but it was still as powerful all the same. And it's such like a seminal film to experience that it's such a weird way to experience too, because it was kind of like a connecting tissue, as you said, between the two of us that we didn't really realize until much later.
Yeah. I really, knowing that you've watched Akira in your childhood and went through and, you know, had the vision of that animation, from so long ago, I kind of understand why you are the person you are today.
I definitely saw it too young. Like, I was much too young to see a film like Akira, because
that was, it is a very, in terms of like the Canadian and American national guideline rating system, it's definitely a hardcore R.
I wouldn't say, well, yeah, maybe it's up there, hardcore R. Yeah. There is nudity, there is like visceral gore, there is a lot going on in this film. I was definitely too young for it, but it's that weird thing about Otomo's style. It's a very pleasant kind of style, and it's so rounded and appealing, especially with his, like, the way he designs faces, I feel. Like,
yeah.
the faces of these characters, Kaneda, Tetsuo, they are so, they're so wide-eyed, so innocent, so appealing that the material that they work with later on is so striking for that very manner that it's presented in such a like a childish way.
Yeah, the animation itself is very addicting to look at. You get like all these, in this film in particular, you get all of this like softness with the faces that you were saying, and all of that kind of 80s animation, which was I would say is a rather prime timeline for anime, with Dragon Ball, like things like Dragon Ball, Shin-chan, and that kind of era developing. For toy animation as well. So it was like the 80s were a nice prime base for the animations, for the animation style to thrive. And with that softness, we kind of had that added psychedelic, a kind of like nighttime-esque nostalgia, if that makes any sense. A psychedelic nighttime-esque nostalgia. I like you kind of like look at the ways that some of the explosions and some of the fever dreams are depicted, and you instantly get reminded of like the 60s and the whole drug and acid culture, if you know what I mean, Chris. Like,
mm-hmm. it is like some nightmare fuel that is going on in this film, and it's very affecting. Speaking more to the idea of this, the way it presents itself in this very kind of acid trip, nightmare kind of psychedelia that it really tries to strive for in trying to present Tetsuo's mindset as his psychic powers are driving him slowly, intensely insane.
Those moments where he's going insane feel so real to the viewer. Like, for example, in that little fever dream he was having, you know, have you ever been sick, taken maybe, I don't know, NyQuil or Neocitrin, and like you are out for a good 18 hours, but are waking up every 3 hours with the same fucking nightmare over and over again, and there's no way to get that nightmare out of there because you're just sick in bed, and this is what your body is making you do. It is making you shut down and succumb to whatever nightmare that's kind of infiltrating your brain there. And it was the way it was animated in here was so, it made me sweat. I don't know about you, but it made me like have beads of sweat coming down my neck and stuff.
But yeah, like you were mentioning how it's like a nice kind of baseline for 1980s animation. This is actually the apex of that decade's animation output, because up to that point, this is the most expensive anime film ever produced. Like this was ever. At the time, because this was a deliberate attempt to make like a blockbuster anime film. Its budget was around like $1.1 billion, which was like $9 million of that time money for us. But like there had never been an anime production with that much money attached to it. So this was a huge undertaking, both for Otomo as like a like second time director around. Like he did a short film before this, like as part of a collection, but this was like his first major project. And yeah, it really shows, because they threw a lot of money at this to make it flow so well, to innovate as it does. And it set a benchmark for anime films moving forward, as well as just like the science fiction films, either from the Japanese context or otherwise, because this is a heady, dense text that few others have really tried to replicate, both in terms of its effectiveness as well as its themes.
That's actually very interesting that it was one of the most expensive productions for anime, because looking at the cast list, there aren't, especially like at that time, they weren't huge, they didn't possess a lot of star power, quite frankly. This was a very relatively newcomer cast, and you know, counting the fact that I'm assuming they had these the three children, the three little Progerian alien children, voiced by actual children, who, as far as I know, don't have many sustainable credits here. But yeah, you could tell. So we could only assume that the $9 million itself actually went into the actual production rather than the actual advertising.
Well, this was before anime film was considered a viable medium. Like this was well before like Ghibli became the major box office appeal that it was. This was like the prestige anime film to set the bar for all, like to all that follow. So yeah, the cast might not be as like memorable or as interesting as you would hope, like because it wasn't about star power. Every single dollar went into the production values, because this was a humongous undertaking, and it's all there on screen. Like few films of this period, or even like the decade right after that in the 90s, look right. as detailed, as significant, as layered as this one is. And it's why like it's such a major canonical thing in both the history of Japanese cinema and anime. And also, it didn't make its money back at the box office. It barely took back that money, because it was a huge investment. It didn't really hit those big numbers until it got opened up in other countries. Like this was a huge kind of export for them, and that's where all the money came from, because this film really opened up anime fandom in the West. Like without Akira, yeah. there wouldn't be like this kind of fandom that we have today.
Exactly. I heard that the manga itself, was the manga released after the film or before the film? Do you know?
The manga was started before the film, but it was not finished yet. Originally like Otomo's major work, and it had like a decent run up to this point. But the film itself deviates a lot from it, because the manga had gone really, really far into its plot, to the point where it's a side-by-side comparison, which I don't want to do for this podcast because I haven't read the entirety of Akira yet, but it's so different and a lot darker than what Akira, if you can imagine that. with what Akira the film comes up with. So yeah, like the manga was definitely in production.
I know that the manga itself actually became a commodity and a rarity.
It was a bit of a rarity, but there have been re-releases since then. The last one I can remember was like October 2017. Kodansha, the original publisher, released this huge bound collection, which is really expensive, but it's available, so.
The expense rise up when you're making a masterpiece like Akira.
Well, like I said, it was the most expensive film up to this time. It was, you know, put together with an Akira committee of producers, which is usually only for prestige films, that are bound to get like award consideration or really clean up at the box office. This had a lot of confidence behind it, and it really shows both in the production and its reception and legacy that followed it. It really changed things, and I do love it. Like if that doesn't come across yet, we are both fans of this movie, despite how it made us feel when we were younger.
Yeah, despite how I had to take a 2-day break from talking to Chris for a bit, being like, why did I watch this again?
It's not an easy watch.
Yeah, it takes quite a bit of stamina, I would say, just to kind of, number one, to watch, but even if you're watching objectively, it takes quite a bit for you to realize what's happening in your body many days afterwards, because it does leave, like I said, a really visceral impression on you.
Think about it. Think about this film. Like, it opens with, like, a single shot of Tokyo getting destroyed in a massive explosion.
Yeah, because like when you take a look at the way of that opening shot with the bomb, you're instantly kind of taken aback because you don't really see that kind of atomic bomb imaging since, unless it's talking about World War II or Grave of the Fireflies. So, you know, right from the beginning, you're instantly traumatized, so to say.
And think about it, what it'd be like for a Japanese patron of the theater watching this film, because you see the text on screen that says like July 16th, 1988, aka the year that you are watching this film, and to see the city that you're probably watching it in go up in just this mass of all-consuming lights. It's
right.
It's like just a statement to begin a film with, and it hits so hard. And it really kind of sets you up like that. This film is going to take it to that level and go beyond it. And hilariously, the film itself like it takes place in 2019. So
yep, we're like, oh hey, that's now. And think about it. Back when we first watched it, it wasn't 2019 yet. So we were thinking, hey, we got time to fix ourselves. But hey, no, it's now. It's funny that we're doing this in this year right now. Mm-hmm. And it even predicted the 30th Olympic there. It's a 30th Olympic Tokyo. They predicted 2020 somehow.
It's a fun thing there where it's like the Tokyo 2020 Olympics is a not central plot point, but kind of like window dressing of this film. It's in the background, and like the final confrontation takes place at the stadium that is going to serve as the Tokyo 2020 Olympic ceremony. And it's funny because I've been wondering for a while if the actual like 2020 Olympic committee is going to reference it at all, because this is not a good representation of Japan at that time. This is a deeply critical, ugly film. I don't know why you could turn that into celebration for the sake of the Olympic game.
I would be extraordinarily surprised if they've somehow made reference to that within the media PR, just because of how big of a deal internationally the Olympics are and how countries kind of prepare themselves for the PR of their own tourism and stuff like that. So I would be heavily surprised and actually kind of astounded if they manage to do any reference. But to me, the whole looking at the stadium kind of be torn to sheds reminds me of when actually I went to Hiroshima and I was able to see the Hiroshima atomic bomb dome. And what they did there, Chris, in Hiroshima is they left the dome destroyed. So I got to see the dome itself looking like the way it did when the atom bomb actually destroyed the architecture, and that's what it brought back to, like, that's what it brought me back to, because like seeing it wasn't as destroyed as the atomic bomb dome in Hiroshima, but seeing a stadium, you know, kind of get damaged here definitely brings back up that that painful, I guess, memory for those who have actually gone through this and those who were watching it in the theater.
Mm-hmm. It was like, I think it was like Susan J. Napier who in like her seminal essay Panic Sites kind of like makes the point that, and using Akira as a specific example, that Japanese science fiction is kind of obsessed with its own national destruction, and it plays it out constantly, like both like from like the early 50s cycles of like, you know, the kaiju films, and how it kind of fetishizes its own like city's destructions, up to Akira, yeah, which goes through a whole cycle of destruction, rebirth, and destruction through its like decade spanning plot. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting for her to say, especially with the it is very true that Japan does kind of thrive on its own destruction, but more than anything, more than the destruction of its own place, it focuses on the rebirth, whereas Akira itself, you know, the rebirth is destroyed. We don't exactly end on the most positive note. There is some sort of like optimism at the very, very end of the film, you know, thinking everything's gone back to normal, but it's, the fact is like nothing can go back to normal after that. You know, it's kind of like a little bit of more, this is like one of those films where the destruction is far more focused on than the rebirth cycle itself.
I think it's more saying with its destruction is that when we constructed this massive megalopolis known as Neo-Tokyo, it was done on, like I said in the intro, like a shaky foundation. Like, this city is in shambles, and it is so close to tearing itself apart, and it does, like, throughout the plot, where the JSDF mounts a military coup and takes over the government, and eventually this leads to its own destruction once more. But that destruction is kind of necessary in the end, because it was like, you see these long kind of portraits of the lower levels of the city and how it's crime ridden, how it's all like, it's like a capitalist hellscape, and like, right, motorcycle gangs are literally roaming the streets at war with one another. And so it's not like Neo Tokyo was the ideal that we were all striving for. It was no utopia. So it had to once again be rent to the ground. But it's interesting because at the end, yes, there's a bit of an ambiguity between whether or not it's ultimately like a positive outcome. We do get that nice shot of Kaneda and Kay and third guy riding into the sunset while buildings are falling from the sky around them. But we also get that other ending of Tetsuo in another kind of like dimension, creating his own universe. So it's the ultimate kind of rebirth that we see. So like at this one point this character Tetsuo, who destroys his physical form because he's unable to contain his mental capabilities, becomes, yeah, a god in his own right and starts a new universe. So trippy.
Yeah, I've written these two quotes that kind of embodied that were in the film. Number one being, there ought to be a future we can choose. And number two, because it's already begun. And these were both towards the end of the film. This is where they kind of realize the whole, damn, we fucked up kind of a deal here. And what's funny is, like, there's so many little things, like, there's so many little moments within the animation that kind of instill the panic of the fact that they had all fucked up as a nation, or like have all taken on the fact that they were irresponsible with themselves, such as like the scenes of announcing a state of emergency for the country and for the city. You know, that kind of brings up the audio in that, when they're announcing the state of emergency, that kind of instills the whole, oh god, what do we do, the whole societal responsibility that Japan is kind of notorious for, especially at this point, as well as like the one thing that, like, my personal favorite imagery there was the Buddhist who was corrupted in himself screaming about corruption. You saw, like, did you see that? Like, do you remember that Buddhist with the fro and the sunglasses? You know, he's obviously like very infiltrated by the Western culture and Western materialism. You know, he has like these expensive ornaments around him, and he's chanting about corruption throughout the film and how we are corrupted and how we are failing as a society, but him himself is rather corrupted through his, like, it's like a catch 22 there. It's a funny little catch 22 where you're thinking, wait, yeah, we are corrupted. Wait, what about you, dude? You know?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because that character is Lady Miyako, who has a much more expanded role in the actual manga, as in like as a major ally of like Kaneda and Kai, as the story progresses. But again, because this was adapted for the screen, it's completely changed around to the point where she is just more window dressing, and to show this kind of discordant public pulse that is going on in Neo Tokyo, and how she's attempting to rally people around this coming savior Akira, because they don't know what that means, and her role is reduced to such a way that she wouldn't know to begin with. And yes, you say like he and this guy, because like she does have a male voice in the film for whatever reason. But yeah, like that's what I kind of love about this film, is that it has, even though it's not really dwelled on, it has all these kind of factions going on within its plot, and they're conspiring and crossing paths make up the bulk of this plot, which is all centered around this one character, Tetsuo, slowly gaining these godlike powers. Like you have the gangs, which Kaneda is firmly a part of. Then you have that resistance movement that has Kai and I forget his name, like the one that Ryu is the name. And then you have the parliament, which is completely corrupt, and the parliament splits off into both the military arm and then Nezu, who is related back to the terrorist cell. So it's this densely interwoven fabric that is making up the city, and that very nature, that it's so discordant, it is so positioned against itself, is why it'll inevitably fall, because there is no unity there.
There really isn't. Yeah, you're absolutely right with that. I really appreciated the fact that they were able to show this kind of structure divide, or this capital tier and the divide between them, for that kind of oh my god, I really need to get my thoughts together, Chris. Hold on.
It's fine. Like this movie does that to you. It is there's a lot going on to it, and despite the fact it's only like around 2 hours long, it condenses so much plot that is the manga into a very workable 2 hours. And
it's a very dense 2 hours that kind of really fuck you up in a way that you don't realize it until afterwards, because there's still so much imagery and still so much devices that are still kind of left unturned, you know? Because, like, why... Where does, like, the moral argument or capital corruption argument come into when the obvious climax of the film happen? Where does that whole Akira kind of destruction leave the, like, what is the viewer supposed to be taking away from that?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say, because a lot of this film is not necessarily hard to read, but at the very least plotted in a way where you can see it from multiple sides and perspectives. Like the whole idea of this military coup that happens in the middle of the film is mounted by Colonel, hold on, I have his name somewhere, Shikishima. It's hard to tell exactly if this is Otomo like advocating for, like, is it like a militarist positive kind of portrayal, as in like sometimes we need the military to step in and take over in order for the right thing to be done. Like, as long as parliament is in such disarray, it cannot be trusted, and we need a strong arm forward. Like, it has that reading baked into it, but it's all in the matter of what the film is actually trying to say. And I don't think it ultimately does not fall towards that reading, or like a lot of these readings, it doesn't put itself fully behind, because it really wants to give you the entire scope of what the city is like and how it functions, and it, or how it dysfunctions, if you will. And it is a complete mess, and within that mess is a lot of corruption, a lot of evil people doing evil things, and it just, and we just kind of have to accept that. Even our protagonists are not good people. Like, Kaneda and Tetsuo are criminals. And
speaking of the actual characters, I think it would be a disservice if we didn't actually talk about their actual stories and how it kind of rolls and ties into the film. Like, for example, with it's revealed that the children that were kind of taken in and experimented on all were together. Yeah, like, they were all affected by the experimentation and kind of taken advantage by the government in order to, I guess, protect the people, but it, in the end, it doesn't really protect anybody.
It's a moral gray zone. Like, that's how a lot of these this operation works, is that they are stopping these characters, like the Espers, from developing into what Tetsuo becomes, but we see the toll it takes on their bodies, and it robs them of their youth and their whole childhood. So it's that moral
Sorry, I wrote down, like, wait, are these children affected by progeria, or did something happen?
They are just ugly designs, but I think it's part of the point that to keep them under wraps, it takes a toll, and that may not be the best thing possible, but it's just what it is, because otherwise they could all turn into what Tetsuo does. And I do want to, like, mention the opening shots of the bike chase that happens, that kind of, like, introduces us to the gang.
Yeah, I wrote Fast and Furious before Fast and Furious.
Why are you insulting Akira like that?
I'm sorry, that's what came up in my mind.
I wanted to mention that because I love the way it's a manner of introducing us to these characters, but also introducing us to the setting, to the city. Because as they are speeding through these twisting, impossible highways, like, the film uses that multi-plane camera technique to kind of show Neo Tokyo unfurling before us, like, in the bottom half of the, like, there's that one famous shot of the skyscrapers passing by the screen, and behind it, as it unfurls, there's just bigger skyscrapers behind them, all brighter and towering over them. I just love the way that it shows that this megalopolis is such a imposing figure, and how much bigger Tokyo has become. Like, again, imagine, like, someone in Japan at the time, 1988, looking at this Neo Tokyo and wondering, like, holy shit, it can get bigger? Like that's terrifying.
I love the cinematic city, the way the cinematic city was portrayed in this film as well. It's just, it gives, like you said, it kind of provides that viewer with that shock, like, oh my fucking lord, how much more are we going to be able to, like, expand on our already huge city? It's, I also love the winding highways and the kind of Neo-Vegas vibes that it gave. You know, it was like Vegas but amplified, I wrote down, because I couldn't write anything else clearly. But in order to, like, distract from the beauty of what Neo-Tokyo can become, there's so much dirt and decay that is given great detail, such as, like, the riot behavior, as well as, like, the homeless around.
Oh, see, like, I thought it was that specific portrayal of this, like, class division between, you know, the pretty face of Neo Tokyo and the slums of it that Kaneda and his gang are, like operate in and exist in. I think that's coming more from, and this is very specifically related to the Olympic angle of the 2020 Olympics. I think it's a direct reference to the 1964 campaign, wherein for that Olympics, that Tokyo Olympics, what they did was a very, well, there's no other way around it, but then to say a very shitty thing that the Tokyo, like, the Japanese government did, was they cleaned up the streets of Tokyo in preparation for the Olympics, as in to put a good face on it, you know, for the international audiences. But all they really did was just push all the filth somewhere else. So it cleaned up the streets very superficially. So all of the homeless people that were occupying the streets, they were displaced. They weren't homed. They were just displaced, as well as like all of the sewage streams and all that. They were just paved over or thrown dirt on. So it's a very kind of like superficial clean that they did on the city in the preparation moving up towards the Olympic Games. So I think that's exactly what Akira is referencing here.
Yeah, countries in general just do very shitty things before the Olympics in order to prepare themselves. They kind of need to put up that front in order to increase their tourism and in order to, like, actually satisfy the, I guess, their own country as, like, when they're the host, they're trying to make themselves appear better than they are. It's like your auntie's house all over again. You know, you probably come to your auntie's house, it's clean, but you know for a fact that she just shoved shit under the couch. It's all good.
I mean, Tokyo's doing that right now. They're doing that right now by really trying to expedite their whole cleanup process after 311, you know, Fukushima, Tohoku region, and that whole major fallout that happened from that triple disaster. And it's very much not finished. Like, a lot of those areas are still both A, in disarray, and B, have a lot of residual radiation fallout, but they won't tell you that. They are really just trying to direct all of your gaze towards the big, nice Olympic stadium that they built, because that's just how the Olympic Games work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Unfortunately.
Shanghai was very notorious for that as well, and Shanghai actually tried their best to kind of clear up their smog situation, and
Oh, you mean Beijing?
Beijing,
right?
My bad. Beijing. You know, the only thing I remember from Beijing was they replaced their child singer with a more attractive little child, but that's beyond the point.
That's hilarious. That's my favorite thing that the Olympic Committee has ever done. It's like, this child singer that we have, she's not attractive enough. It's like, what the fuck are you saying?
Yes, this little girl is ugly. Let's put a cuter little girl in her place. Oh god, that's I felt...
Therefore, our country's good.
I swear to god, Japan, you do that and you're gonna get some harsh criticism from me.
Okay, breaking away from that, I really want to talk about the music of this film.
Yes, please do. Please, please. It's so haunting, so catchy, and so bone-chilling. Please talk about
it. Yeah, like, you've never heard a score quite like this. It was written for the film, obviously, by a multimedia project called, it's the most frustrating name I've ever seen in my life, Gaino Yamashigurumi. Sure.
Wait, let me, hold on, I'm gonna go look it up, let me see.
So, yeah, like, they were the ones who performed the music, and it was composed and conducted by Shoji Yamashiro, pseudonym of Tsutomu Ohashi, and performed by this collective of artists and musicians, and it is so affecting. Like, it's mostly a percussive score, which takes a lot of inspiration from, I think, like, Indonesian music, specifically a very specific percussion instrument that they use for that kind of world music stage. And it's so amazing how it's able to score these films through this combination of these percussive animalistic kind of sounds with an a cappella chorus, like, screaming the names of the characters. It's so unnatural to anything you kind of heard before, and it almost doesn't work with a lot of the images it shows you. But that throbbing percussion that you hear as, like, they're speeding through the streets of Neo Tokyo, it gels so perfectly that I think it's, like, one of the all-time greatest film scores ever.
Yeah, like, for example, going back to that fever dream that affected me so much, it was another reason why, you know, it made beads of sweat roll down my neck, is not only with the actual visceral thing of seeing the animation itself, but hearing the weird-ass soundtrack going behind the toys getting bigger and more powerful and climbing on the bed, and it's like a playful kind of horror-chilling vibe over the fact that there's playful, horror chilling animation, if you know what I mean. But at the same time, like, it's a different kind of chilling for both, like, that kind of creates that dichotomy between the animation and the soundtrack, that kind of, any context of understanding you thought you had while watching the animation itself instantly becomes destroyed because of what you're hearing. Like, this is a movie you all need to watch with headphones, because it further loops you into that confusion of what the actual fuck is going on here. I thought I was supposed to be watching this message. However, this message has been tainted because of what I'm hearing over the over what I'm watching. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And just beyond, like, even the soundtrack, like, the reason why you want to watch this with headphones is the sound design. Like, this is some incredible work to really build you into this this, like, a dystopic metropolis that is, like, you can always tell is bustling, is moving, is breathing. The way that it works to really convince you of that atmosphere through it, through its auditory cues, is so amazing. I just love the way it kind of enraptures you into the setting, and just, oh man.
I honestly want to watch this with an acid trip. I want to take some acid and watch. I don't advise anybody to do that, by the way, but
I think that's a terrible idea and you shouldn't do it.
Who knows? But it's definitely, like, it gives you that psychedelic acid trip without needing to take acid, just by putting on the headphones and watching what you're watching.
But when you think about it, like, this is, like, the soundtrack, especially, like, the opening tracks of, like, Battle with the Clowns, like, I'm reading from the soundtrack list, and, like, the Kaneda's theme, like, these are great, like, pump-up music. Like, these are great to add to, like, a gym playlist, because it's so... No, I'm serious. It's so, like, percussive. It is so animalistic. It's so primal in nature that it can just get you going. And it's really kind of portraying the interiors of those characters in that moment of having a gang war between each other. It's a very interesting idea, and it really shows just how much thought was put into the production side of this film, that Otomo kind of, he knew of this band, the collective that's did the music for the soundtrack, and just really wanted them included in it, so that they wrote the score and had them perform it using this very, like, Indonesian flavored kind of gamelan music. And it just sounds so weird and out of place and unlike anything you've really heard before. Maybe that's because I'm not that culturally versed in Indonesian music, traditional Indonesian music, so it just sounds so great. And it's, you can't really find much to compare it to. Like, this was, like, a weird experiment that just worked.
I wanted to actually ask your opinion on something. So, where do you think the whole kind of science-y aspect of this film, like, beyond the capital corruption and beyond the initial message of morality, where do you think the science aspect comes in? Do you think there's another issue with morality with that imagery? Or do you think, like, you know, the science aspect needed to be added for, I guess, grounding?
I'm afraid I don't understand the question. like, is their portrayal of science moral? No, it's not. Like, it's clearly being done for very clandestine evil reasons. And they are deliberately, like, pushing forward on the experiments, knowing full well that they destroyed a city 30 years ago, and trying to contain it, or for some whatever reason, to keep working on it and letting it fester. So, no, it's not. But this is just part and parcel with Japanese cyberpunk as a whole, which this is, again, a seminal text of. Like, this is one of the original kind of cyberpunk films, if not the original one.
Yeah, the original. I was thinking, okay, do you know any before this, or?
Not really, because that genre really kind of really started to take hold in the early 90s, and this predates that just by a couple of years. The other kind of big, if you want to think of anime cyberpunk, would be Ghost in the Shell, and that wasn't until the early 90s, so this did have the leg up on it, and it's all there, like, especially in terms of, like, body horror and how that works in conjunction with science to really test our understandings of what the human body is capable of, especially in that giant fleshy baby thing that Tetsuo becomes at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that?
Do we have to?
I think we have to, because it's one of the most legendary kind of images like that has really kind of
that whole thing actually makes me worry for your child's safety when you watch this in your childhood, because that's the one scene where I'm like, that was what like fueled my need to discuss this when I first watched it. That thing.
Okay. There were two scenes when I first watched it that really like affected me and did not like made me feel really bad, and it made me wonder like, man, maybe that was a mistake watching this movie at this age. It was that scene of Tetsuo's rapid metamorphosis into this amorphous, uncontrollable blob of just ugliness, and it was Nezu, like the corrupt politician's heart attack.
Oh, okay.
That is one of the most visceral pieces of animation and acting that I've ever seen in my life. It's so unpleasant and upsetting to see him struggle to move through the riding streets and chomping down on like his medication all to a no effect and then choking on it. It's so like that one really kind of like put me in a bad place when I watched the film originally. Like I was just so viscerally upset when I saw that.
Yeah, that I actually had a very peculiar reaction to that scene, and that was literally fearing for my mother's life. I had to pause and call my mom. I had to pause that particular scene and be like, "Mama, I can't sleep."
Yeah, it's
I'm an adult woman, and I'm an adult woman living across the country from my mama, and I needed to pause and call my mama. That was something that just brought out the whole reality of sudden illness in general. It's a very shocking scene to see happen before your eyes, because you see a life and then all of a sudden it's gone because of shit that could have actually really have been avoided.
Well, yes and no, because he hitched himself to the revolution, or like, you know, the terrorist cell that was going to really strike back at a government that was in disarray. So he wasn't a good person to begin with. So it's kind of his just desserts. But again, it's just the way that it's filmed, the way that it's drawn, that really kind of hits you at the core and just makes you feel moved in a very disturbing way. And the same can be said about Tetsuo's metamorphosis, because it's very hard to describe, as you said.
Oh my gosh. I remember we had a quiz question on this. Remember how Dr. Annett used to give us quizzes on the film to make sure we watched it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god. I don't remember what the actual question was, but I remember one of my answers was Tetsuo transforms into a grotesque, giant-ass ball of I don't know what, and I'm still affected. I had to write down my personal feelings in that answer. I'm just like...
That was going to say, that's a quality of cyberpunk, where a lot of the times you don't exactly know what you're looking at, but you know that it's organic in nature, and at one point, what you're seeing was a human being. It's kind of like why, in the Tetsuo, the Iron Man series, he's named Tetsuo. I'm pretty sure Tsukamoto, the director of those films, like said that's a direct reference to Akira.
Oh god. It's such a disturbing set of images that no matter how many times you watch it, you wonder whose nightmare fueled this idea. Whose nightmare actually came to life here? Because this is pure, this is something that's like once again, when you're having one of those weird ass fever dreams, this is the kind of shit that comes up in them.
And I like that though. I do like that it's a very kind of emotional moment for Tetsuo, because it kind of completes his cycle. Originally, that we see him, like when we're introduced to the character, he's very much motivated by his inferiority complex as related to Kaneda. And as he gains these powers, it it completely consumes him, and he goes mad with power and thinks himself as a god. And when this happens, it really puts him back into that very naive, very weak state that he was once in, because the powers that he had are no longer in his control. And it's not like his horror comes more from him losing control of his body. That is what really terrifies him and terrifies the audience for a lot of the for a lot of the effectiveness of the scene, is because this idea that our organic material is no longer in our control, that we don't know what's happening to it, and doesn't resemble what we remember it to be. I think the most like horrific scene, like the horrific shot, even before he becomes like the amorphous baby flesh thing, is when after he's shot by Colonel Shikishima, and he's crouched over and he's like covered by his cape, we just see like this mass of flesh and steel fall out from under it, and that's his arm.
Yeah, his arm. Fuck.
Like, that is the most horrific scene, I think, even beyond like the flesh blob that he becomes, because like at that point we see the horror in his eyes, realizing that it's completely out of his control, and it's only going to get worse. And I think now is a good time, actually, because you bring up the voice actors, how great this dub is. This is one of the few anime films that I completely default to the dub. Specifically,
I watched the Japanese. Oh, oops. Okay, yeah. Please talk about the dub.
Oh, the dub is like great. It's like one. It's a very iconic one, like from 2001, which is like I think the pioneer one, the pioneer slash genion English dubbing. This is like one of those films where I've seen it so many times with that dub, where the Japanese voice acting doesn't sound natural to me. It's like they're screaming, and like yet it's all really kind of like overplayed, while these characters, their voices, like the specific kind of qualities of their voice, their tenor, their cadence, like it's so burned into my head that I can't accept it at in any other language.
Oh, really? Okay. Having watched it both times, actually, through the Japanese, I actually think that the Japanese version holds up on its own. Having the fact that they brought in newcomers to be able to voice these characters, I was very pleasantly surprised at the amount of depth they were able to kind of to portray, being able to portray fear. I was also really impressed with the fact that they actually got, like, it seems to me that they didn't get kid actors, they got kids to voice the Espers. They got, like, not kid actors, but actual kids that, like, you know, so, like, for example, having, I believe it's number 25 in the bed, so it's the little girl with the great,
Kyoko.
Who looks like a Kyoko, in the bed, talking about what could happen with Akira and like her vitals going up and her vitals kind of slowing down very, very slowly. It's such a heartbreaking scene for me just because I just hear a little girl dying. I mean, I will check out the English dub here. I'm looking at the cast list right now, and it looks like Joshua Seth, who was in Digimon, the best dub of all time. anyways, yeah, see, I will definitely would love to take a watch of the dub, especially, but at the same time, you probably go back to the dub because that's what you experienced the first time, right?
Oh yeah, like I've seen like the film with the Japanese voice cast, and it's fine. Like I think it works very well. It's not exactly misplaced, but it's just what I'm familiar with because that was how I was introduced to the film, was through the Pioneer Genion specific cast. And I find, because I've heard these voices so often, like the voices of Kaneda and Tetsuo, that I can't like dissociate their image from that voice. Like they are permanently linked to me. And I that's not a bad thing. Like I can appreciate the Japanese voice cast, but I just love it so much because I feel like they knocked it out of the park with these characters. Like I think it's just how they should sound.
I see. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the cast list right now, and in the 1989 dub,
that one's terrible. That one's absolutely terrible.
Okay, I'm just looking at the cast list, and I just need to mention this, but number 27 was voiced by a guy. I shit you not, his name is Bob Berger.
Huh.
Kai was also voiced by Mr. Bob Berger, as was Eiichi. His name is Bob Berger, Chris. This is the most important thing that could come out of this podcast. His name is Bob Berger.
Okay, you're going a little bit crazy here, and you're actually wrong. It's Bob Bergen.
Fuck me.
Yeah. Like, he's a well-known voice actor. He's currently the voice of Porky Pig. Mm-hmm. Yes, I see that. So
you see the list, yeah. Oh, God. But Akira, great.
Good. Yeah, if anything can come across from this podcast is that, like, yes, there was a man who was not named Bob Berger that you became momentarily obsessed with.
But, without further ado, is there anything else you would actually like to mention?
Currently, no. I think just for prosperity's sake, we should talk about the long in development live action Western remake.
Oh, that? Do we actually have to? I knew we had to talk about the grotesque mask, but do we really need to talk about the live action that's coming up?
Oh, no, it'll be quick. It shouldn't happen. Done. There, we're good.
It's just that it wouldn't be so horrible if, like, it wouldn't be so horrible to imagine if we didn't already have, Westernized live action failures preceding it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, if Ghost in the Shell live action didn't happen, like, maybe we could see this working out, but the fact that we have this massive failure of a transnational adaptation of a very Japanese story. The fact that we have a precedent for this never working and no one liking it.
Yeah.
All things considered, I have nothing bad to say about Taika Waititi, but of all the directors in the world, why would you select him? The man known for weird comedies and parodies. Why would you select him?
Is it, or why would he even volunteer is what, like, why would he even take this on is my question.
Probably really super lucrative.
It says here that there was a 7-figure deal made, so.
Yeah, you know, that's, money, there's your reason why.
Money controls everything, and that in itself leads to the destruction of your city.
It's going to happen anyway. It's going to really leave a minor splash at the box office, I feel, and it's going to fade away into obscurity. Like, no one remembers the Ghost in the Shell remake that happened in 2016. Like, no one cares. And Akira may be this massive kind of cultural entity that it's become, both in Japan and in the West. Like, he has had this stranglehold on our cultural consciousness forever. We didn't mention it, but the famous Kaneda bike pose has been recycled endlessly in Western cartoons. So,
right, yes.
Yeah, like, there is this kind of legacy for this film and this want to keep it alive, but live action just would not work for it, especially when this film went out of its way to reimagine how we make animated film, to really do it dirty like that and just put it in live action, aka live action, because it's all going to be on a green screen set anyway.
Yeah, I'm genuinely curious though, because the thing is, Warner Brothers acquired the rights in 2002, and now they're planning the release for 2021. So the fact that they required the rights and had plans to make this live action film, but in that time, other live action films have been made in this time from 2002 to now. You know what? Were they waiting for, really? Were they waiting to perfect it in a certain way, or were they waiting to I'm not quite sure what took them so long, but if anything, I am rather curious to see what kind of product they make after having the rights for that long.
Well, that happens all the time, really, because it's a major production that they have the rights to remake it, but it just gets stuck in development hell forever, because every single time they try and make it or, like, get into the pre-production stage, it just falls through, either through lack of funding or lack of interest or directors dropping out. It happens. And yeah, for something like Akira to be stuck in development hell makes absolute sense, because at the time, you know, 2002 definitely could not have done it justice. Even now, I don't think it can be done justice. unless they really throw that money behind it. And it's been on the back burner forever. I just don't think the interest is there anymore, especially when we have Otomo making a follow-up to Akira that's currently in production.
Oh, that's another episode, Chris.
Well, it's going to be an anime series. It's going to be an anime series, so we won't do it.
That's a bonus episode, Chris.
Actually, like now we're on Otomo, like I kind of want to talk about his career really briefly, because it's really weird.
This is what I actually want to learn about. So please, I want to know what kind of work preceded and followed this.
Well, prepare to be unsurprised and then extremely disappointed in both areas, because prior to Akira, in terms of his filmography, because the man was like a mangakata for like decades before this, like 87 and had two segments of two like omnibus films that he directed, Neo Tokyo and Robot Carnival. He contributed two short films to those. Then Akira happened. Then after that, he made a live action film called World Apartment Horror, which is this really bland, uninteresting J-horror film, which a lot of people were just wondering, why?
Akira is definitely not horror, but it very well could be.
Well, I think within science fiction, especially cyberpunk, it straddles the line of horror, and these kind of generic these generic demarcations become much more muddy when we're talking about something like this. Like, Akira has horror elements in it, and especially with that with that toy scene, like I don't think anyone could deny that's like straight out of a horror film.
It's basically like embodying the elements of horror, but still being like it's basically like having that jump scare, but still saying, "Hey, wait, this isn't horror. You're just watching a film that's particularly had a jump scare."
I've made my peace with it. I think it's just from that initial viewing, like I've never been quite as scared of Akira as I have been since then. And I just think it's a great vision of like this dystopic future. I think it's like a completely realized perspective on a future that should never come to fruition. And I think it's one of the few films that really sets out its vision from the onset and delivers on it later on. I think it's a completely realized feature. And you can't say that about a lot of films, especially not a lot of anime films.
Yes, this is one of those anime films that the effort was clearly placed in developing every single detail like as perfectly as possible in order for the audience to get that visceral and physical reaction out of them. This was designed for the audience.
And like it forever changed this idea of adult animation, because before then, like that was considered a very like unviable avenue to put money into and to promote and to put into production. Akira kind of changed all that. It showed that a lot of people, both in Japan and in the West, were really striving and thriving and just demanding these kind of adult mature stories with a lot of that don't try and like hide away from the more disgusting elements that come with these mature themes.
Mm-hmm.
And it made its money back in terms of like an export. Like it really kind of opened up this idea that there are more like fans of this type of anime in the world. So we can like really credit Akira with broadening the appeal of anime for future generations. How dare you, Akira?
How dare you?
Okay. On that note, I think that's going to do it for us here at Egg and Knight. We'll be back sometime in the future with another episode. Please, if you enjoyed the episode, share it around. Give us a nice rating on your podcatcher of choice. And yeah, anything else to say, Aruba?
Discussing Akira again has reignited the unsettling nature I felt after watching it. So
yes, we here at Egg and Knight strive to give you the bad feels.
Yes, for this week at least. And I would like to say that I really thank everybody for your patience as we're trying to get these episodes out. We know that this year has been kind of rocky. I have moved away. I have moved across the country, so thus with that adventure coming to an end soon, I hope to be able to kind of to be able to produce more and hang out with my buddy Chris. You know what I mean?
Vaguely, I know what you mean. But yes, yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, so we'll keep you updated, and I will be getting a Twitter that which you'll be able to follow soon. So stay tuned for that, you guys.